Today the hall will come to order. The next bill, 5, the reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 75, introduced by the Mineral Committee and Act relating to the Economic Development Account. This bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Byrd, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubbs, Wanitzer, Dave, No, Brechtel, signed Representative Lockhart, Chairman. The bill was further referred to the Appropriation Committee, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phillips, Stewart. Signed, Representing Berger, Chairman.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rises to report it do so at the recommendation that Bill Senate File Number 75 do pass. Members of the 60th, this is the old Amendment 4 provision of our legislature where we under Article 16, Section 12 of the Constitution, we tried to incent businesses, and it would, since it was a constitutional amendment, it takes a two-thirds support for an appropriation. And so that's what we're bringing to you is the appropriation that goes to this particular mechanism to get money for economic development. In the interim, it was looked at by the Minerals Committee. In July, we thought $18 million put in there one time and they'd never be back to see us. By the time we got to the legislature, we cut that by a third on the Senate side to $6 million. When it went to the Senate appropriations, it was cut to $2 million. It came over to the House, and we thought the better part of valor was to leave the $2 million in it. You should have had in your box this kind of multicolored Senate file explanation. There's a lot of material on there. I wanted to give you some history of those loans. The loans have had less than 1% loss rate. There are a couple of loans that are still out there that are at least put on a watch list. Recall that this is money that goes through a banking analysis along with the business council analysis and has had good success. It shows that there are 600 jobs that have been created. Over time, there's been up to $40 million loaned and a good share of that paid back. If you get down to the projections on this sheet that I'm talking about, it looks like in red that what's needed in this challenge loan component, that's the one we're talking about, is about $2 million. Recall, those of you here in the 59th last year, we did a similar kind of thing. We funded it with $2 million spread over the biennium to match what was the expected needs from this particular loan mechanism. And we're back now to add $2 million to it because it appears that about $3 million is what fits this loan portfolio the best. With that, Madam Chairman, I stand for questions on Senate File 75. And if there's no questions, I call for the question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's Senate File 75, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Senate File 75 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 95. Reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 95, introduced by Senator Ross, an act relating to insurance medical necessity review procedures. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bagby, Barbudo, Kennedy, Gingrich, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrich, Chairman.
Chairman Gingrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 95 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, and I will try to explain the Standing Committee Amendment. It looks long, but it's actually doing only a few simple things. One of the things it did on page 5, we had a subsection D, we meant to say subsection C, in on page 4, and then you see it again on page 9 and page 12, we put in some dates, some time periods that we believe that things should be done in. Previously, it had said things such as in a timely manner, and we wanted it specifically defined what we meant by a timely manner, so we stuck in 5 days. So that fixed that problem. And then what the amendment's doing is throughout the bill, there is a phrase, and the phrase is, in the event the insurer applies the provisions of the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, and that's known as ERISA, related to notification and appeal rights, the insurer will be deemed to have met the provisions of the section. We didn't think that worded very well, and plus it was repeated throughout the bill. It didn't really need to be repeated over and over. It just needed to be in one spot and just say, this applies throughout the bill. So we deleted it completely out of the bill, and you'll notice the committee of the whole amendment, those two representatives worked hard and came up with some better language that we just couldn't come up with in committee. But after the committee meeting, they came up with some language that will actually work. So that's what the standing committee amendment does. And unless there's any questions, I'd ask for an aye vote on the standing committee amendment.
You've heard the motion on the standing committee amendment.
Madam Chairman, I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understood the explanation about the deletion on page 14, lines 18 through 21. That's the language that's... Which language is in there more than once? So, this thing, an insurer?
Mr. Representative Gingrich?
No, I've got it, Madam Chairman. Thanks.
You've heard the motion on the standing committee amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Gingrich?
And Madam Chair, it might be just simplest to go directly to the good representative from Campbell County, Duke Committee of the Whole, and then finish that out.
Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 95. And I appreciate the good chairman's description of what we tried to do here. If you look on page... on page 14. Sorry about that. On page 14, near at the very end. The ERISA language, as was explained, was throughout the bill. And it's because of concerns about how those federal laws apply to some of the provisions that we're looking at doing here within this and our medical review. This is a great concept, something we want to do, but we also want to make sure that we're covering those pieces that might bring confusion. And I think that if you look at the amendment that we are bringing, we're saying that those who are required to comply with ERISA and do so will have some protection under this. When we had the prior language, it was clumsy, and it appeared to give people an option that they could go through and either comply with ERISA or comply with Wyoming law. And that was not the intent of the bill, and that was not what we wanted to see. So what this amendment does is it makes that very clear, and I would stand for questions on that. I hope that it is pretty much self-explanatory.
We are on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 is adopted. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Chairman Gingrich.
And Madam Chair, if we could turn this over to the good representative from Casper, he will explain the bill in more detail.
Representative Stepson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill before you is really aimed at ensuring that those who pay premiums for health insurance are awarded the benefits, sort of get the bargain that they have agreed to through the health insurance policy. And it really is made up of two components. One is it sets up a review process if a claim, an insurance claim, is denied. And the second element of it is it sets up a definition of medical necessity. And the bill, its structure, the first The first 15 pages deal with the external review process, and essentially what it does is it requires insurance companies to set up a review procedure to ensure that when they make a denial of a claim, that it is reviewed and that it is done so in a timely manner. And there are two separate review procedures that are required under this law. One would be an internal review that the insurance company does. They would have to provide, if they do deny the claims as part of this initial review, they have to provide a signed opinion of one credited medical consultant and have to explain why it was denied, and then provide a statement to the policyholder that it has been denied and they have a right to an external review. So if they get through that first sort of line of defense, then it moves to an external company that would review the claim for benefits. And the way this would work is there are a number of these companies out there across the country, and they have to register with the insurance commissioner. And the insurance commissioner reviews these companies, makes sure they're qualified. He has the list of qualified external reviewers. And so when an insurance company denies this claim for benefits, they have to send it out to somebody outside the company, this external reviewer, to see if the denial is or is not appropriate. And the real step forward that this signifies is that before, there was no requirement to send it to somebody outside and independent. Before, you as a claimant, you may have your insurance claim denied and you could ask for a review, but the insurance company quite likely would send it to either somebody in-house or somebody that they have a contractual relationship or some sort of business relationship with, and it left you as a claimant a little bit uncertain as to the impartiality of that review. This cures those concerns by allowing it to be sent outside to an independent reviewer, a reviewer that's been approved by the insurance commissioner and that is listed and that is on a list provided by the insurance commissioner. Once it goes to that external review process, there's again a time frame for them to review. In the statute, there's a number of guidelines as far as the materials to review, who can provide the materials, both the insured and the insurance company. And the external reviewer then has to provide a decision that, again, spells out whether the denial was appropriate or not, and if it was, what's the basis for the denial and why was it appropriate. After that external review, if the external review comes back and says, no, insurance company, you messed up, you should have paid this, then if the insurance company still refused to pay it, then the bill provides that that's essentially an unlawful trade practice under the insurance code. And that is on page 15. It's under 2613.124, Unfair Claim Settlement Practices. And so the statute basically says if an external reviewer says you insurance company should have paid this and you refuse to do that, that's an unfair settlement practice. And so that's sort of the first chunk of the bill, this setting up the review procedure, the timelines, and those sorts of things. The second part of the bill is the definition of medical necessity, and you'll find that on pages 16, 17, and 18 of the bill. And what this really does, and you see this a lot of times in cancer cases especially, where you may have a medication that has shown some efficacy, but it may be an off-label use. But it can still be perhaps widely known to be an effective treatment for certain kinds of diseases. Under many policies, those can be denied right now, as even if the doctor and the patient decide that's the best course of therapy. And what this does is it opens up the definition of medical necessity so that it, you know, the FDA is so slow sometimes on approving these drugs. This allows you to go in and say, look, there's medical literature out there that supports the use of this drug. My doctor thinks this is the most effective therapy for me. So under this definition, it's medically necessary, and it would be something that the insurance company would have to pay for. The other aspect of this is it sets up a sort of uniformity around the state. You're not going to have maybe a low-ball insurance company coming in with some sort of medical necessity definition that allows them to screen out a lot of claims. It's going to set all the insurance companies on the same footing in that respect and allow some consistency for reviews of claims across the state. And so that is sort of a thumbnail sketch, but it really gets at the heart of what many claimants, the concerns of many claimants, and it sets a much more even playing field, allows those claims to be reviewed impartially, and if in fact they're worthy claims, mandates that they be paid. And so with that, I'd answer any more specific questions anybody has on the bill.
If there are no further questions or discussion, are you ready for the question? Question being called, all those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill number Senate File 95 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Senate File 95 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 62. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 62, introduced by Senator Ross, an act relating to Insurance Discretionary Clause Prohibition Act. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Korberg, Throne. No, Patton, Peasley, signed Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 62 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. What the Standing Committee Amendment does, on page 2, line 8, when the sponsor originally drafted this, he was going to have this apply to also disability income protection coverage, and it was decided not to cut, to have it apply there, so that needs to be deleted out. So the bill only has applicability to health insurance benefits, not to disability income protection coverage. So that part gets deleted out there in the purposes section on line 8.
Representative Throne.
Madam Chairman, did we vote on the Standing Committee Amendment?
No.
I guess I call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment, and then I'll explain the bill.
All those in favor of the Standing Committee number 1, Amendment number 1 to Senate File 62, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would turn over the explanation of the bill to the representative from Laramie County.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This bill is intended to provide consumers in Wyoming with essentially what we like to call the benefit of their bargain. When you enter into a contract, whether to buy a car or lease a piece of property or buy a business, the other side, generally speaking, cannot usually go, King's X, sorry, didn't mean it. Essentially, Senate File 62 is intended to prohibit health insurance companies from denying consumers what they bargained for, what they've paid for. A discretionary clause essentially says, no matter whatever else we've said in the contract, whatever benefits we've promised you, whatever we've said you get for paying premiums for years and years and years, we have the sole right, the sole discretion to say, oh, sorry, you don't really get the benefits you bargained for. And the worst part of it to me in terms of the discretionary clause is that the consumer really has no recourse. Because if they go to court, they're subject to what is called the arbitrary and capricious standard, which makes it virtually impossible for a consumer to challenge the decision of the insurance company. So really, it really puts the consumer, the patient, at an extreme disadvantage, and in my opinion, really denies them the ability to benefit from the premiums that they have paid for years and years, or either perhaps the premiums that their employer has paid. And, you know, and generally speaking, those of us subject to insurance policies, we don't have a lot of choice in negotiating those. Some of us benefit from various employer plans. And essentially, you pay premiums, you expect benefits, and then when you need them, you discover they're not there. And many states have banned these discretionary clauses. Some insurance commissioners have done it through regulation, but because Wyoming does not have statutory authority to allow our insurance commissioner to take steps to protect Wyoming consumers, this bill has been brought forward. And between me and the good representative from Southwest Wyoming, I'm sure we can answer your questions.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Fellow colleagues, I certainly rise in support of this proposed piece of legislation. It's a false sense of security when you enter into a contractual relationship with a party and you expect both parties to stand up and fulfill the obligations that they signed on. In this particular case, that's not the way it'll be because of this discretionary clause. And what happens when you go into a medical procedure, there are things that can happen during that procedure that exceeds or goes beyond the scope originally intended. And all of us in this floor, of course, have studied your medical coverage in great detail and understand exactly what it says, which is a rare occasion. What we do, though, is we know that we have medical insurance. We expect to be covered if we have major medical or whatever the provisions and clauses may be. But what happens here, you'll frequently find that this discretionary clause comes up, and in contract law, it's the only place I know of where you have this abnormality, that the individual is one of the parties has the absolute discretion here to void various provisions of that. And it has devastating results because you can go in for surgery or whatever the case may be. You think that you're covered. You come out. It's bad enough to go through the medical procedures. Then you have the financial procedures that can attack you because you may have 50% that was paid by your proposed insurance, or you may have less than that. And it raises lots of concerns and lots of questions that's in it. Some of the language that you'll find in your medical contracts and provisions, it says these magic words: the plan administrator has full and complete authority and discretion on all plan matters. Now think of that a minute. When you signed up that contract, I don't think the insurance salesman sat down and says, by the way, now we have this clause that will hold you high and dry if you ever need it. But at the same token, I need the premiums paid in a timely fashion, because if you don't, then I will take other evasive matters that's not in your best interest. But they forget to mention that the plan has complete discretion along these lines. 12 states have taken affirmative action to avoid these particular things, not allow them to be in the insurance business so that it protects the consumer. On the other side, the insurance companies can look at this and say, well, will we have an increase in rates? And looking at some of these other jurisdictions, there has been a 2 or 3% on certain cases raises that's taken place, but it really hasn't crippled the industry in that particular regard, because you still have recourse to the courts. You still have the provisions of what we just passed this House on general file, and that was 95. So I think that there's adequate protection for our insurance people as well as us as a consuming republic. So I would unquestionably recommend passage of this piece of legislation.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As I understand it, I think 46 states have the what we just looked at in Senate File 95. I'm not sure how many states have the discretionary clause prohibition. But I wonder, is there any data that indicates one way or the other whether the discretionary clause prohibition impacts premiums? I've been told that there is no good statistical evidence that that is the case, but I wonder if that's true. And I'm on and for the bill.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a partial answer to the question that was just posed in regard to the number of states that have this type of ban. And in fact, there is only one state that has legislated a ban on discretionary clauses. 9 states, I believe, have rules and regulations, but only one state has legislated a ban on a discretionary clause. You've been circulated a letter, you found it in your desktops from two of the largest health insurance companies in Wyoming. And the statement I want to call attention to is that all insurance clauses contain some form of discretionary clause, which basically says the insurer reserves the right to interpret the terms of the contract. It doesn't say, as has been suggested, that it reserves the right to void portions of the contract. It reserves the right to interpret the contract. There wasn't a lot of pushback. In fact, I don't think there was just really minor pushback from insurance companies on HB 95, which set out an external review process to allow and to provide to the insured some means of resolving conflict over claims. And the reason that there wasn't any pushback from the insurance companies is very good, and that is that external review is based on, and you heard we just went all the way through it, but basically decisions are made on the basis of evidence-based medicine. And I think with passage of HB 95 such as we just did, there's really no need for HB, or excuse me, Senate File 62. They are not linked. They are not coupled in my mind, and so I am on and against Senate File 62.
Representative Jorgensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On and in support of Senate File 62, as I've said before, I've tried to follow the health care issue, and it's very difficult to do, but one of the elements that become pretty obvious is that our insurance commissioner does not have much leeway in the information that he could request or ways that he can enforce requirements on insurance companies. This is not, excuse me, a state with a large number of competitive insurance companies. And unless you have a comprehensive coverage in health insurance, you're not really spreading or sharing the risk. And that's what insurance is all about. The other item that I think is important is that this begins to put the insured on a level playing field with the insurance company. And I applaud those who brought this issue because though it's a small step, it's a correct step in the right direction. I urge you to support this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a question for the sponsors of this bill. And the previous comment was, you know, putting the policyholder on a level playing field. How is that going to look? I mean, what's this level playing field? Because are we assuming that by passing this, the insurance companies will stop saying no because they don't have a discretionary clause? Is that going to decrease the number of no's? What's the playing field look like for the policyholder? Are they still going to have to litigate? I'm assuming that they are. Does this just make litigation easier for them? They're still going to have to litigate. So, I'm assuming. Obviously, the policy that the insurance company can just increase the premiums or decrease the lifetime maximum, or there's all kinds of ways. I mean, most of these companies are for profit, so they're going to find a way to continue to sell policies. But just explain to me how the playing field will be more level.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I rise to suggest to you that you, as a body, just passed House Bill 95. House Bill 95 had an incredible amount of testimony, some of it just terribly graphic. The interesting part about that is that nobody gave credit to the fact that the insurance companies that were present and testified in favor of House Bill 95. It provided not only for an immediate review with a timetable attached to it, but it also provided that if that review wasn't satisfactory, then there is an external review. And the third point that is important to understand here is that the insurance companies aren't just bad guys sitting there trying to make life miserable for the claimants. Out of the 2 million claims that they had in the last year, they only had a few in which they found themselves contested. Not a bad record, not a bad record at all, particularly in light of the fact we have watched the health insurance industry, the insurance industry, diminish in people and firms that are willing to participate. We're down now to only two carriers that are domestic carriers in the state of Wyoming. The House Bill 95, in my mind, which I supported, did the adjustment factors that are needed and required and give protection to the insureds. Give them an opportunity to make the insurance carriers be responsible and to act responsibly. The insurance commissioner, who was also in attendance, has not seen fit to act to remove the quote-unquote discretionary clause. And I'm reminded of a story that, seems like we're full of anecdotes here, of an insured that came into my office and said, John, he said, I've got the front of my truck is all damaged, and I need a new bumper, a new grill, that the car is really severely damaged. And I said, how did that happen? And he said, well, the wind did it. I said, wind did it? How did the wind possibly do that kind of damage? I looked at his policy, and his policy didn't have collision coverage on it. He obviously collided with something. Well, the story unfolded that he parked the car, the truck, at the top of the hill and forgot to establish the parking brake. The wind, he claims, blew the truck off of the top of the hill and down into the corrals. And thus, it was wind damage. Now, I happened to be, at that time, the first line of defense for the interpretation of the contract in behalf of the insurance company. And I said, friend, I got to tell you, if you want me to send this in, I will. But you know what the answer is going to be? They're going to come back and say it was collision. It was not wind that blew it off. And if you want, we'll check the weather report to see what the wind velocity at that day was. He smiled and said, well, I said it was a nice try. Somebody has to make the decisions. Somebody, being the administrator, ultimately makes the decision that says a claim may be denied. But with 95, you provide for an adjustment, a reasonable one. I think that 95 did what we need for the people of the state of Wyoming, and I don't believe that we need Senate file number 62, and I urge you to vote no.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I will do my best to respond to everybody's questions. First of all, 12 states have banned discretionary clauses. It doesn't matter whether they've done it through rule or regulation or through statute. It's still law. Through exercise of law, 12 states have banned discretionary clauses. And the reason we are approaching it statutorily is that our insurance commissioner has told us that he doesn't have authority to ban discretionary clauses. We don't give our insurance commissioner a lot of authority to ban discretionary clauses. I think it's also important to note that banning discretionary clauses is consistent with the organization of represented by national insurance commissioners. It's considered model language. As I mentioned, 12 states have banned discretionary clauses. More than 46 states have already done what we did in the last bill. But it was presented to us, I mean, for once, can't Wyoming be in the lead in protecting consumers, in protecting the people of the state of Wyoming, instead of trailing behind? With what we did with House Bill 95, we're kind of on the tail end of the game. But with House Bill 62, we would be ahead of the game in protecting our citizens and ensuring that they get the benefit of the bargain that they've negotiated for in their insurance contracts. And, you know, we certainly hope that House Bill 95 addresses problems. But when the insurance companies have discretionary clauses in their hip pocket to that in some cases may allow them to undo what we did with House Bill 95, it certainly leaves open the possibility. That's why we need both. And finally, in response to whether this levels the playing field, I wouldn't say it levels the playing field. The insurance company is still going to have the edge. It really just gives the consumer a fighting chance, because with discretionary clauses and the presence of an arbitrary and capricious standard of review, which is virtually impossible for the insured to win, with an arbitrary and capricious standard, the insureds under current law with a discretionary clause really don't have a chance at all. Not one at all. But with this bill, they'd have a fighting chance. But they would still have to prove that the insurance company did something wrong. And that's really all the consumers are asking for is a fighting chance to get the benefit of their insurance contract.
Representative Hales.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a client in Casper whose husband was denied medical care for his type of cancer, and it was brain cancer. He had medication that had been prescribed by several experts in the field, and it was still denied. His wife and a group of her friends took to the streets with signs and petitions, and finally the medical carrier decided that they would pay for his treatment. With cancer, even though there may be a review process, it's a fast-moving disease, and you don't have a lot of time for the treatment to be denied to go through stages of review. So I think that we need to think about the time involvement here and the position that it puts these people in. So I'm on and for the bill. Thank you.
Representative Peasley.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was on the committee that listened to this, and I'm sympathetic. There always is the sad story, and I have family members that were victims of this. On the other hand, what I am unimpressed with is the lack of comprehension after listening to that testimony, other than that bad things happened. I don't understand and didn't learn it as to what the economic underpinnings were for this. I am very much aware that this idea that somebody out there can tell you you don't have that right or aren't going to get that benefit, and I hear that every time I deal with a state agency or a federal agency, try to tell the Social Security Administration you've bargained for something after 45 years and be told no. Somebody makes a decision, and it's usually the person holding the money. And so it wasn't explained well, it wasn't articulated well, but what did come to me on the basis of those brief hearings we had was that usually a insurance company has statistics and actuarial data upon which to base a decision as to what they can pay out. And the problem is not with accidents, because they're statistically reliable. Deaths, they can predict that within a matter of days, it seems like. But health is a moving target. There's always new and innovative procedures, and it's difficult to categorize or to calibrate what you're going to do in terms of paying. And so I was left with the impression, and I voted against this in committee, at least if I didn't, I meant to, because I'm just not persuaded that we have really heard the whole story. The insurance industry did not do a good job of arguing against it. They presented a few position papers, but it almost worried me, because they will not come with poster children and examples of horror stories. They will just pack up their bags and leave the state. And I have had, and I'll bet you there aren't half of you that have had to pay for your own insurance for the last 35 years. But I tell you what, it's a tough slog out there. Before I retired, I was paying $1,900 a month for myself on a $10,000 deductible. And in 30 years, I have never received a dime from that insurance company. And I just dread to think that we're going to do something based on some sorry stories and some sad situations, and we're going to run up the insurance premiums for that other poor fellow behind me. So I'm worried about it. I'm worried that there's a lack of comprehension, and I'm troubled by the fact that the concept of somebody having discretion to say no is abhorrent to us. Because every time I go to the post office, I'm told no. I have clerks at court or county clerks that tell me, no, I'm not going to take that and give you a new title. People make decisions, and then it falls back on you to push it a little further. So I'm on and against this bill today. Thank you.
Representative Bagby.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I, too, was on this committee. And I'm standing in favor of this bill. The largest representative of senior citizens in this state testified at that committee. They highly support this bill. We had a lot of very, very emotional testimony, and some of it to the fact that insurance companies are overriding doctors. And I think a doctor probably knows a lot more about how to diagnose a person's disability or liability or cancer more than an insurance company. A lot of these people feel that without this discretionary clause that they are not going to get a fair shake. And I sat there and listened to testimony after testimony. And I believe those people. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't understand why an insurance carrier could not interpret their contract with the insured without the discretionary clause. Because in a variety of insurance contracts that I've seen in my career, you have to read them so closely, and that there can be a question of coverage. And here we're talking about whether the procedure or supplies that are given are medically necessary. And the claim is that Senate File 95 takes care of that. I haven't seen an example of how a discretionary clause reads either, and I would like to see that. But if it simply says we can interpret our contract as we want, that raises questions about fairness and whether or not the insured understood what they were signing. But when I look at Senate File 95 more closely, I see that it talks about, in one section, a claim for payment of medical services being denied, and then another section talks about a claim for medical services, procedures, or supplies. And I think that makes a distinction between will you pay for this versus will you provide this. But I think in many circumstances that's the same question, unless you've already paid it. But what I see in 95 is that on one hand, if payment is refused for that procedure, and it's determined that it a delayed review would be critical to the claimant, that it would be reviewed within 72 hours. But the claim for medical services, procedures, or supplies is a 45-day period. And I don't understand that. So if the real question is, are people getting the care that they think they contract for under their contract, Senate File 95 provides you a quick remedy. I don't know that it does. And why couldn't an insurer simply say, like you can with any contract, well, that's not the way I read it. And then so people sue each other about that. And I'm not convinced that there has to be a discretionary clause in an insurance contract so the carrier would have the ability to contest some type of service.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm not going to try to repeat the good words of our representatives from Sheridan and Powell and Douglas and maybe other places, but to say that this is a small step versus a big step, I think is a little bit of a put down of what we're looking at right here. The discussion of having 12 states that have eliminated or through regulation made the discretionary clause different than it has been over the years says in the reverse that there are 38 states that have not taken any action on this. One of the questions was asked is how many there were, and I happen to get a list here, and it's from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and there are 38 states that have not taken any action on this. As you reflect back on what the good representative from Sheridan said, when somebody starts the claim process, somebody has to say, yes, that's covered, let's get it done, or that's not covered, and you start the process. With what we did with Senate File 95, I think we've put some processes in place that are going to give you better review from more objective panel, if you will, rather than just the insurance agent and the customer. Now, all of that said, there's been some tragic cases, and all of us have heard those, and each of us, I'm sure, have examples of those on our desk. But I think this is a big step, and when you start forcing two things, one, increased cost on insurance companies, what happens, they raise their rates, and they start losing insured people, and then that pushes people back into our uncompensated care through the emergency rooms and other places. So if it drives people away from having insurance, which it can, that's another thing. The second thing is that if you start what I'm reading into this Senate File 62, that you're going to have arbitrary decisions, or not arbitrary, different opinions, we're going to start more litigation and defensive medicine. And defensive medicine also raises the cost. So I would urge your caution on supporting this bill, because I think it will have an adverse effect on when we really want to help people get good insurance and get it when they need it. And there was a statement made that this hasn't been a ripe state for insurance companies. I just happened to, over the years, watch how many have come, made initial preliminary offers at low rates, and then when they start racking up the cost and that sort of, they're gone. We're really down to a very small number of insurance companies that even try to do business in the state of Wyoming. So think about that as you ultimately get to voting no on this Senate File 62.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question was asked earlier as to what the actual clause looks like in a policy. And there's actually one on your desk that got handed out, and I'll just read part of it. But it says, the plan administrator has full and complete authority and discretion on all plan matters. Therefore, the plan administrator has given to the claims administrator authority and discretion to make decisions regarding the plan provisions and determining questions of eligibility and benefits. This next sentence is the important sentence. Any decision which is not arbitrary or capricious shall be final and conclusive. This is the important sentence to understand. So let's say you go in to have a surgery that under your plan, it says it covers that type of surgery. You get all done. You submit your claim, and all of a sudden the insurance company says, well, you know, we're not actually going to cover that. It's our discretion. We've decided not to cover that. So if you go to court now and you're going to argue in a court of law that, wait a minute, I paid my premiums. You said you'd cover this type of claim. Now you're not paying it. The only decision the judge gets to make is not whether or not it was in the plan and not whether or not you paid your premium and got and paid for that benefit. The only decision the judge gets to look at was, was the decision arbitrary and capricious? Not whether it was the right decision, not whether or not the benefit was actually written in the plan. Arbitrary and capricious just means that you weren't crazy when you made the decision. That the person doesn't get on the witness stand and say, yeah, I'm the plan administrator, and every Tuesday I decide not to honor that plan, that benefit anymore. That's arbitrary and capricious when you say every Tuesday I'm not going to honor that. But almost everything else is always going to beat that standard. So essentially, by having a discretionary clause in your contract, what it essentially means is the plan administrator, even though you might have a list in there of all the benefits you supposedly get, they can make any decision they want, and it's final and conclusive, and you can't argue it even in a court of law. That's what this is trying to fix, and that's why discretionary clauses should not be in these contracts, and I would urge you to vote aye.
Representative Patton.
I want to thank the previous speakers, in particular the speaker, in talking about the time factor and the decision making. He did point out very correctly that if a decision is made that is unsatisfactory and desires to be challenged, it may do so within 72 hours. And within that 72 hours, then a review will be had and will be made and be in hand. What hasn't been said by all of the legal minds in relative to support of 62, I rechecked this to make sure on page 1, page 2, page 3, and page 4, the only timeline that is there is the effective date. The result of that is that if you think that you're going to go to court, do you think that you're going to get a decision faster than 72 hours? If it's on a weekend, are you going to have the court ready, willing, and able to make a decision for you? The accident or the incident occurred on Friday, and on Monday morning, the court is going to be there saying, hey, come on, we know that the insurance company is wrong. That isn't what's there. What's written, what's in a document, what we have put into law is 72 hours. There's not one mention in four pages of 62 that suggests you're going to get a speedy trial that's going to help out the cancer patient that needed to have a faster interpretation relative to his or her coverage. I think we're talking about the wrong thing. I think we really ought to be talking about how to assess the insurance industry to perform on behalf of the clients that it serves. And remember, two of those companies, major companies for us, are domestic companies. They live with us. They're a part of us. They're not there to try and discourage us. They're there to try and serve us. I suggest the defeat of 62.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I certainly appreciate the debate. It's been great. I knew there would be various discussions, viewpoints expressed on this issue, and I'd like to leave the floor with this thought. With the insurance contract you have, would you prefer to have one that is valid and you can rely on, and if you go into medical surgery, that it will pay in accordance with what you negotiated in good faith and paid the premiums on and met with the people and discussed this, or would you prefer to go into surgery or some other procedure with uncertainty, unknown, and perhaps come away with a large medical bill? And with that, Madam Chairperson, I call for the question on the bill.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 62 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 62 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 46, School District Facility Lease Fees Limitation. Reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 46, introduced by the School Facilities Committee, an act relating to school building, school district facility lease fees limitations. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubno, McKim, McComey, Teeter, signed. Representative McComey, Chairman.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 46 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And, Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd turn it over to the good gentleman from up by 25 a ways to explain the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senate File 46 essentially allows school districts to lease closed or surplus school facilities to certain qualified entities without requiring them to make a lease payment that is sufficient enough to maintain the facility. Currently, you have to make a lease payment that is enough to deal with the major maintenance issues. This bill will allow certain entities such as licensed child care, developmental preschools, and BOCES. The Standing Committee Amendment deletes the ability of licensed child care facilities. There was a constitutional question with Article 16 in the state constitution that in the context of a very low or free lease payment to licensed child care facilities that are fully independent of the state, the issue is whether or not that district has essentially made a donation and is in violation of the constitution if they allow someone to lease the building for free. So I guess at this point I would ask for your aye vote on the Standing Committee Amendment.
You've heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number one has been adopted. We're back on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The bill is very simple. Once again, it simply allows school districts to lease the unused, closed, or surplus school facilities that they might have in their possession to these BOCES or developmental preschools at a reduced or free cost. And I would stand for questions.
Question. Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that bill number Senate File 46 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Senate File 46 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 53, Property Tax Deferral Program. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 53, introduced by Senator Jennings, an act relating to taxation and revenue regarding property tax deferral program. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlick, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 53 do pass. And I would also like to move the Standing Committee Amendment to number one to House Senate File 53 at this time. And I would turn the explanation of the amendment and the bill over to the good representative from Riverton.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is an interesting bill. Is this mic working? It's been kind of quiet today. You want me to move to another mic? Thank you, Madam Chairman. I noticed that earlier that mic was kind of quiet, and the representative from Carbon County, I could hardly hear back there, but I think you all can hear me better now, so hopefully you're out of your nap now. And I think actually this is a really interesting bill, and it's one you need to remember to take back home, because we're back on property taxes. We thought that was all behind us, but here we have another property tax bill, and this isn't really a new bill. It's existing program that's been in place for over 10 years. It's a local county option on property tax deferral. So again, this gives a little bit of local control to help ease the pain of increasing taxes with your constituents back home. But the county has to put it in place. So the pressure would have to come on the county commissioners to get this put into place. What it does is the existing law allows people to defer one half of their property taxes for payment. So it could provide an immediate impact to their bottom line. So again, this is one of the tools, one of the talks, one of the things we were concerned about when we came down here was property taxes. This is along that line, and you can take it back home and say, this program's in place. It's a local county option. Only two counties right now have this in place. And what this bill does is makes it a little bit more permissive. The means testing becomes quite a bit more generous. And with that brief explanation of what the bill is doing, I'm going to walk you through the bill and walk you through the amendment at the same time. So on the amendment, we go to page 1, line 3. The amendment, all it does is scratch out old provisions and inserts provisions in there instead. On page 1, line 8, after N, insert intro, Roman numeral 2, by creating a new subdivision, Roman numeral 3, and by renumbering Roman numeral 3 as Roman numeral 4. On page 2, line 14, after if, insert the owner adequately demonstrates on his affidavit that he has limited income as defined in subparagraph M of this paragraph, and that's the new language inserted on page 2, line 14. Page 2, lines 16 through 18 are deleted. Page 2, line 21, the stricken or is reinserted. And on page 3, line 10, we're removing some old statutes there that talked about 1995 and the program was in place for 10 years. So that's the amendment. And, Madam Chairman, I'd ask for the vote on the amendment.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 53, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment has been passed. We're back on the bill.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Again, what the bill does, go to page 2 of the bill. The new language has inserted under lines 13 and 14 the amendment on page 1, lines 8, 9, and 10. So it reads into the qualifying of the primary resident. You have to sign an affidavit and submit it. The person, there's two requirements here. The first requirement is that it's means tested to the your monthly income, and it can go up to 250% of the federal poverty level. This is the major change. It used to be 125%. It's increasing it to 250%. The other part of the bill requires that one of three other items must occur. You have to qualify under the needs base. Then you have to be one of three other items. On page 2, lines 20 and 21, you have to be 62 years of age or older. On page 3, lines 1 through 3, you have a disability as determined by the Social Security Administration. And on page 3, lines 5 through 8, the owner purchased the property at least 10 years prior to the beginning of the tax year. So again, you have to have the means testing 250% of the federal poverty level. Then you have to be at least 62. You have to, or you have to be handicapped, or you have had to been in the house 10 years or longer. So that's the bill. Again, this defers your half of your property tax. The county has to ask for this. And what I understand right now, only two counties have some of this in place right now. Teton is one of those, and I believe Sheridan is the other. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On and for the bill, I think these are great additions to an already good existing law. In our county, we were one of the two counties that that has this program. It started off slowly, and we've slowly built up the number of people applying, mostly because we've spent a lot of time mostly at our senior center giving a little seminars, explaining it, encouraging people to take advantage of it. There was definitely a concern amongst folks that they didn't want to put liens upon their own home, that this would somehow hamper their children when they died. And we've explained to them, you know, wouldn't you rather have a lien on the house than your child not even get the house because you've had to move out of it. But my main question is, over on page 3, lines 5 through 8, the 10-year requirement that you have to be in the home for 10 years, one of the things that we've seen is when people reach retirement age in our community, they're downsizing. They're going from a bigger home down to a smaller home, perhaps a townhouse, something like that. And so then they're not qualified to do it. Was there any discussion of either getting rid of that requirement or lowering the 10-year threshold down to something a little bit more manageable, like 3 or something like that?
Representative Jorgensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like a clarification from the sponsor. As I read page 2 at the bottom, it's been deleted where it says or under item 2, so that the way I understand it now, you would need to have a disability in order to qualify. Is that a correct interpretation? Thank you.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The or on page 2 was reinserted with the amendment. So you can do one of those final 3 items. You can qualify under either one of those, either of those 3, just one of them, not 2 or 3. You can qualify under any of those 3, plus you have to have the means testing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yes, that's right. If you're over 62, you qualify. Don't have to have been there 10 years. You don't have to be disabled. You qualify if you're over 62 and fall below the 250% poverty level. If you're 22 and you've lived in your house 10 years since you were 12 years old, you qualify. So that takes care of that. I would also like to add that it's already in the present law on this that counties can be reimbursed for that by going to the state treasurer. And the state treasurer is authorized to take over the lien and loan the money at the 4% interest from the permanent mental trust fund. So the counties can be made whole. No counties that have done this have bothered. I think the most they've put out on this is about $22,000, so it hasn't been factored. But if it grows big enough that the counties think that they need the money this year, they can get it from the state treasurer. That's already in the bill, already in the law, and at 4%, and the state treasurer takes over the lien on the property. That's the only qualification, again, is the 250 of the poverty level, the way it reads. And then if you're 62 or over and only lived there, just bought your house, you're eligible. If you're disabled, you're eligible. And if you're lived in your house 10 years, probably you'd have to be a little over 20 or 22. But nevertheless, if you've owned the house 10 years, then you qualify regardless of your age.
Representative Landon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have 2 questions. Sometimes in these deferral and credit programs, there'll be a number of them that refer to specific statutory specifications. Did you check to see whether other programs were using this 3913107B3M as one of the standards to qualify for other programs? That's one question. And the second question is, as we had done this last time, I didn't understand I don't know that we were interpreting there to be a household income ceiling. That the language that says or allowed those other persons, no matter what their income was, to qualify for a deferral. Is that correct? And finally, the third question I have is I haven't looked up what the repealer is.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader?
I don't know if the good representative from Fremont County wants to answer those questions before I add a few more, or because if it were me, I couldn't remember all that.
Mr. Miller?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm going to answer questions 1 and 3 of the fine representative of Sheridan, because I forgot number 2. He'll have to ask that one again. But the first one was on 3913B, Section M. And, you know, I didn't check to see if this affects other statutes referring back to this section, but I'll definitely check it as soon as we're off the floor here and see if there's anything else that refers to that. As far as his third question, which talked about the repealer, I did comment that what that is addressing is when the law was put in place in 95, it had a 10-year time frame on it then. So it just repeals stuff that doesn't even apply right now.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
I think I forgot my question. No, just kidding. Just briefly, a couple things. I'd like to know what incomes correspond to these increased percentages of the federal poverty level. And the follow-up to that is what's the percentage of participation in the two counties that have taken advantage of this? And if it's not 100%, what's the purpose of increasing the eligibility from 150% to 250% of the poverty level?
Representative Miller?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The 250% of the federal poverty level in 2008 for a family of four is $53,000. So that answers the first question. The second question, it's my understanding that I believe in Teton County there was only 4 people that participated at this income level. In Sheridan County, I haven't heard any numbers. Maybe just 1 has participated in Sheridan County. So we're trying to make it somewhat more permissive for folks. You know, 53,000 in Teton County, I suppose that buys your lattes every day, you know, for the year. But, you know, that's the best I can do, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 53 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 53 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 17, Mental Health and Substance Abuse. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 17, introduced by the Mental Health Committee, an act relating to mental health and substance abuse services. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne, no, Mercer. The bill was further sent to the Appropriations Committee, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phelps, Stewart. Signed, representing Berger, Chairman.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 17 do pass. And I guess I'll explain the bill. Just to remind everyone where we're at with mental health and substance abuse and where this bill sort of comes from. Back in 2005, this body created the Select Committee on Mental Health and Substance Abuse. And that committee's job was to try to improve our system of how we deliver mental health and substance abuse services in the state of Wyoming. How we presently do it is we appropriate money to the Department of Health. Department of Health then contracts with local centers. They're called WAMSAC centers. These centers are private groups that are nonprofits that are run by boards, volunteer boards from your own community. That center is where the actual services are actually provided. When the committee began meeting in 2005, they took testimony across the state and discovered sort of what needed to be done. And one of the things that really came out of those meetings was this concept of regionalization. The idea that within each region of our state, we had centers sort of overlapping one another, some centers doing a lot, some centers not doing a lot. And so the concept came up with, within each region, we need to make sure that we're at least providing the basic provision of care. And so we divided up the state into regions, and you'll see sort of a list of them on section two there listed out. And so you can sort of see which region you live in. And the concept was that in each one of those regions, we would all the different types of services. Let me give an example. Therapeutic foster care. There's no reason for two counties sitting next to each other to have an administrator overseeing therapeutic foster care. So one county does the administration part, but the service is provided in both counties. That way it actually ends up saving us money, so we're not duplicating the bookkeeping, the administrative part, and those type of things. But the service is still provided. In 2006, we appropriated money for pilot projects across the state on quite a few different programs that we were looking at. In 2007, we funded in a very big bill, and then again in 2008, we funded all on this path toward regionalization. The other concept of regionalization, especially when it comes to mental health, is that what you're trying to do is keep the individual in your community rather than sending everyone to Evanston to the state hospital, trying to find means of helping that person locally and quickly and efficiently, so we're not spending a lot of money at the state hospital. This year, the committee came forward with a bill that was much larger than this. It was probably 10, 14 more pages than this document here. This certainly got some haircuts along the way, and a lot of the different programs got pulled out of this bill, and we're only left with one program, and actually within that one program that's left in the bill, only two parts of that section. And that's what's left is the crisis stabilization beds. And actually in the original bill, the crisis stabilization beds, it was for every region, all the regions that have not been funded yet. And this actually centers down to just two regions, the Basin region and Southeast. And again, Basin is defined as Bighorn, Hot Springs, Park, Washakie. And then the Southeast, we define as Albany, Carbon, Goshen, Laramie, and Platte. So this bill only deals with the Southeast region and the Basin region. So let me explain what a crisis stabilization bed is. So let's say someone has a schizophrenic break. They're not on their medications that they should be on, and for whatever reason they decide not to continue taking their medications, and suddenly they have a schizophrenic break. Or someone tries to commit suicide, and so they're picked up by the police or they voluntarily come into the hospital and say, you know, I need some help. Under normal circumstances, we go through a process, and that person gets transported to the state hospital in Evanston, and their stay can be anywhere from a week, 2 weeks, to months, if not years. What we're trying to deal with here with crisis stabilization beds is those people that voluntarily, so these aren't people that are being forced to do anything. It's a voluntary process. And we offer them to stay in their own community at our facility. And these facilities, like the one here in this city that we're in today, theirs is a house, essentially. It's a house that's fully staffed 24 hours a day. These folks can go to that house, and there's a bed for them available. We get them back on the meds they need to be on. and you get them stabilized. And once a lot of these folks, once you get them back on their medications, and then you work out a plan for medication dispersal, maybe they come back to that facility on a daily basis if they so choose, to get their meds administered to them, to hand it to them, because a lot of times people just forget to take their meds. But we get them stabilized so that they're back out in the community, so we didn't spend the amazing amount of money that we spend at the state hospital, where a lot of times they're sitting at the state hospital day after day just waiting to be transported back to their normal community or back to the community they came from. So we started this as a pilot project in this city, and it turned out to be a huge success. They ended up saving the state of Wyoming, and this is from the Department of Health, they're estimating around $3 million. Where they compute that is, it's money that they didn't have to spend at the state hospital holding that person. So we end up with savings by doing this. And also it helps the person because now they're not being transported. We stabilize them very quickly, and then they can come back into their community. So we did it with the Southeast region, and then we did it with the Western region. The Western region has it. And we're trying just to get it to each region. We're trying to be fair and not just give all the money to one region. We want to make sure every region has the same program. So we went to the Western region, and they've started theirs up, and theirs is about to open, actually. It takes a little while to get these things in place. The money we gave them last year is about to come to fruition now. The major region, in all of our discussions in 2005, 6, 7, 8, every time we have any discussions, especially when it comes to psychiatric care and mental health of citizens of our state, it's the basin that we always come back to having large discussions about. Because of their, I don't want to say isolation, but they're further away from some of the more major cities, and they have difficulty getting to the services. Also, within their region, their services, for whatever reason, are just not up to the level that other regions of the state are. And so we've always highlighted that we really need to get money to the basin region to increase the level of care that they can provide. So that's why the basin was the one pulled out of this to be funded. And this would provide money for the basin region, and this would be done through a bid process type thing. And so one of the towns in that vicinity would have to put in for it, and it would actually be through one of these WAMSAC centers, and they would explain why, one particular town would be better than another and more centrally located, or they already have the infrastructure in place or whatever. You'll notice if you look at what we've paid, like for the Southeast region or for the Southwest, the basin is costing a little bit more money. Again, that's because we already had stuff to work with in the other regions. In the basin region, we're sort of starting from zero and working up. So that's why that $770,000 is there. That explains the basin. Then the other part of this is $148,000 that goes to the Southeast region. Again, Southeast region doing really well here in this city. And actually, I shouldn't keep saying this city. They actually have two locations. They have one here, and they have one in Rawlins. So they actually have two. The same center is running two different branches, one in this city and one in Rawlins. The 148 is needed because they're doing so well, and they only bid for a smaller time period, and they did not bid for the full time period. They now realize that that was a mistake. They should have bid for the whole thing. So the 148 actually allows them to continue the services that they're already doing, and it will allow the operations to continue. The 148 is actually not the full cost. They already got their funding. They need the extra 148 to catch up with this mistake they made on the time period of which they were bidding for. That's the only, those are the two things in the bill, and then there's section two there that explains what each region is, and that was more just so people knew what the regions were, within the state that we had sort of, I don't mean to say arbitrarily, but we had just chosen as the regions. I mean, there's been some discussion of moving some counties out of different regions, but that's certainly something we can discuss on another day. And I would stand for any questions.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd just like to ask the sponsor. I believe I heard him say that the department is saving $3 million a year. And if that is the case, then why are we not using that savings to fund this program? Thank you.
Chairman Gingrey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, that's what we did last year. Last year, that's where we got the money to fund the Western region and actually to fund quite a few things in the bills. We had a big bill last year, too, and we ended up not having to pass that bill because the Department of Health stood up and said, well, actually, we've saved $3 million. We'll take that $3 million and use it for all these other projects that were in the last year's mental health bill. So it actually got used last year, and it was sort of the idea of the Appropriations Committee that that was a good use for that money that was saved.
Mr. Speaker?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On and strongly for this bill. Folks, we've been trying to get crisis care up in the Bighorn Basin now for over 2 years, and we haven't been successful. We have a bill that was laid back on third reading today about Title 19 costs. We are having a problem with the county not wanting to pay the hospital for Title 19 costs unless certain collection processes are followed. And that is because we have the choice of a hospital or a jail. And we need crisis stabilization where people can stabilize and not have to spend $2,500 a day in the hospital for no care. It's ridiculous. There will be savings. You could ask certainly why this hasn't been fixed on a regional basis, and that those are good questions. But the first step to this is establishing the crisis stabilization beds, and this is critical that it be done. This was intended to be a pilot. The pilots have been very successful, and I urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 17 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Senate File 17 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 103, Child Abuse and Neglect Amendment. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 103, introduced by Senator Ross, an act relating to child protection, child abuse, and neglect amendments. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bagby, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne. No, Mercer. Signed, representing Mercer, Vice Chair.
Chairman Gingrey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 103 do pass. There are some Committee of the Whole amendments, but I'll hold off on those until the good sponsor, the representative from Gillette, has been able to explain the bill in detail.
Chairman, or Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Hold on to your socks, brothers and sisters of the 60th. This is going to be a long one. Senate File 103 changes the child and abuse neglect procedures. And to understand what the bill does, you have to understand what the process is. And this is a process for terminating parental rights. And so what happens is we have 37 pages of Wyoming statutes that deal with parental rights and how we take a child from a family's custody. What happens is law enforcement or somebody receives a report, the child's taken into protective custody. The maximum amount of time that that child can be held in protective custody is 48 hours. As soon as possible, you know, we have a shelter care hearing, but it has to be within 48 hours, and we have to notify the child's parents, guardians, or custodians at that point in time. Then we have a temporary placement hearing, and there and that's a full hearing under 14.3.4.12. It has to occur within 48 hours. At that hearing, you have to advise the parents of their rights, including the contents of the petition, the right to counsel, the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses, the right to a jury trial, the right to appeal, and then you also have to advise them that if the child is in foster care for 15 of the next 22 months, the state is obligated by federal law to terminate the parental rights. Then you have the hearing, and the court determines whether full-time shelter care is appropriate, release to the parent, guardian, or custodian is appropriate, or release to the custody of DFS is appropriate. And 14.3.411 requires the district attorney to conduct a full and fair investigation and take action in the best interest of the child. Then if the district court after, or the district attorney after the investigation determines that it's in the best action to take an action, 14.3.412 requires a petition that requires the child's name, date of birth, address, names and addresses of the child's parent, grandparent, guardian, or custodian, whether the child is held in shelter care, the names and addresses of the facility and the time the shelter care commenced, the facts and detail upon which the petition is based, and whether there are any facts that aren't known at that point of time, including the location of one of the parents, which is what the problem is that this bill tries to address. Then the court issues an order to appear, and it says you must appear in court, and that you have to appear and hear and say things, or be advised of your rights and participate. And that's in 14.3.413, which is one of the sections that's amended later on. 414 provides for service of process. It says that if the parent is within the state of Wyoming, that you can have personal service. If you're outside the state of Wyoming, you can be served by certified mail. But the person who's providing that service has to file an affidavit under oath stating the efforts that were made to find all of the custodial parents. This will be changed in the bill, and we'll talk about that in a minute. 14.3.415 talks about failure to appear, and basically what happens if you don't appear is that you can be arrested and brought before the court and held in contempt of court for not participating in a hearing dealing with your child's best interests and essentially forced to participate. 14.3.416 requires the appointment of a guardian ad litem. So the child has an attorney appointed for them in the process. And as you'll recall, in the past couple years, we've spent extensive research and extensive resources and extensive legislative time making sure that these guardian ad litems are qualified to be guardian ad litems. 417 provides subpoena power. 418 gives the district attorney search warrant power. And as you'll recall, a couple years ago, I stood up on the floor and opposed the search warrants because I thought that was a little overbroad from the state of Wyoming. But the wisdom of this body overruled me, and now I've been convinced. 14.3.419 provides for physical medical exams and emergency medical treatment. 14.3.422 requires, again, an appointment of counsel. So if parents cannot afford counsel of their own choosing, the state provides counsel for them. It requires that they have the right to advice of counsel. 423 requires a copy of all of the charges against the parents, the abuse and neglect. It requires the right to explaining their rights, including the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses, introduce evidence, present witnesses, and otherwise be heard. And it also gives the parents a right to trial by jury. 14.3.426 sets forth the hearing process. It's a detailed hearing process. 427 requires that DFS create a social summary, including a social history of the child, environment, condition of the family, performance of the child in school, abuse history of the family and parents, mental health and substance abuse risk factors, and other material matters. Then we appoint a multidisciplinary team consisting of the child's parents or guardians, school representatives, DFS representatives, mental health professionals, the DA's office, the child's attorney, volunteer lay advocates, foster parents, and then any other people that we deem necessary. And 5 days before a hearing, the multidisciplinary team makes a recommendation to the court. For the court to vary from the multidisciplinary team recommendation, in 429, the judge has to tell very specifically why. 429 sets forth the terms of the order that the child remains in the custody of the legal parents, the child's placed under protective supervision, we transfer temporary legal custody to a relative or other suitable adult, we transfer it to DFS, the boys' school or the girls' school or the state hospital, and then it allows the court to impose a whole series of conditions. And then the court's required to conduct a review hearing every 6 months and a permanency hearing every 12 months. If the child is in foster care 15 of the most 22 recent months, then the state's obligated under federal law and in state law by this statute to terminate the parental rights. And then there's a right to appeal to the Supreme Court. All right. Given all that, here's the problem. You have parents who all of a sudden, after 22 months, show up and go, oh, no, wait a minute. You can't do this. You didn't serve me. I was the non-custodial parent. I didn't really participate in the process. And so you have to go back to square one. And so for another 2 years, this child is not, well, 22 months, is not in a permanent position. So what Senate File 103 does is on page 2, it allows that if you're doing an adoption, you can combine the files of the adoption with the juvenile proceeding. On the bottom of page 2, it allows that if you're doing a guardianship, you can combine those files into the juvenile court hearing so that you don't have two court hearings. Page 3 says that if you fail to comply or refuse to participate in a case plan, which is that whole process that I described to you before under the department, that in and of itself is neglect. Now, you have to understand how the child got to this point. There is a report of abuse and neglect. We've gone through the whole process. DFS has put together a case plan that says this is what you have to do to reunify your family. If you don't participate, then that is grounds for neglect. On page 4, it allows for combining files, again, in the juvenile court proceedings. The bottom of page 4 and page 5 talks about that notice that the parents must receive. And what it requires is that you tell the parent a whole bunch of things to make sure that they're fully informed that if they don't play, if they don't come into court, and they don't participate in this process, they're going to lose custody of their children. The notice requires, if you look on page 5, that a petition's filed, that the non-custodial parent has been named in an action, that if you don't file an answer within 60 days, you lose, that if you fail to respond to the notice or appear at the hearing, it may result in your termination of parental rights, and that other options may be considered for placement of the child. Going on to page 6, we talk about, again, what the notice provides. It says that the non-custodial parent shall be served with a notice of the child protective proceedings that tells the non-custodial parent that you have to appear, that you have to admit or deny, that you have to show up and submit to the jurisdiction of the court, which is managing the future of your child, that you have to cooperate with the Department of Family Services, that you have to provide information as required by the court to the multidisciplinary team who's going to make recommendations on the disposition of your child's future, and you have to pay support ordered by the court. And going on to page 6, this is the language that says that if you've been served and you fail to respond, you can't show up and go, hey, wait a minute, you got to delay this another 2 years. 143414 says that you can be served by publication under the Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, you have to understand that if you're served in the newspaper by publication, you have to file 2 affidavits talking about all of the steps that you have to take to provide service, and that if those affidavits aren't true, that service of process can be quashed and you can go back and have the hearing. So you can set aside the bad service. 143427 says that if a parent chooses not to comply or participate in a case plan developed by the department, that if you for 15 to 22 months didn't do anything, didn't show up, didn't participate at all, you don't have any right to object after you've been told all of the things that we told you earlier in the bill. With that, I stand for what I know is going to be a whole series of questions.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. What this amendment does, primarily, if you look on page 3, it deletes lines 2 through 16. And what that's doing is, that's the definition of what neglect is. And neglect means a failure or refusal by those responsible for the child's welfare to provide adequate care, maintenance, supervision, education, medical, surgical, or other necessary care for the child's well-being. What the amendment, or what the bill was doing, it added in this clause that I find somewhat disconcerting, this clause that says, or a failure to comply with or refusal to participate in a case plan developed by the department. That's somewhat problematic because sometimes you're just going to disagree with DFS. Maybe they've put in a case plan that you need to do X, Y, Z, and you just really don't believe that you need to be doing X, Y, Z. And suddenly, instead of just objecting and saying, I don't think I need to do that, suddenly you can be charged with neglect of your child because you're not doing exactly what DFS said. Now, the court can order that's what you do, and get very specific, and then the court can have, you know, put the hammer on you. But it just seemed a little odd to have in there that you have to comply with the case plan or you can be charged with neglect. And the other part of the amendment, over on page 7, it's the same kind of issue that I had. On page 7, it deletes 11 through 19. And here it says, if a parent chooses not to comply with or participate in the case plan developed by the department, that parent is prohibited from later objecting to or complaining about the services that were provided to the child and the family. It's sort of the same issue I had with the first one. So if I don't comply and then I'm not allowed to complain later, well, you know, I can complain about a lot of things. I don't need a statute telling me I can't complain. That's what this amendment does. It deletes those two sections out of there that I didn't think were really needed in the bill. I'd stand for any questions on the amendment.
We are on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd urge you to resist this amendment. What this amendment does is it essentially guts the bill because it grants, again, the power to show up and go, well, hey, wait a minute, and delay things for another 22 months. I do agree with the good representative from Teton County that this language could use some polishing. I think it's better that we do that on a second reading amendment than throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Representative Gingrey.
I just want to say, I certainly didn't mean to gut the bill if that's what the good representative from Gillette thinks it does. I didn't really think it had much relationship to any of the other parts of the bill. But if he thinks it guts the bill, I don't even know how to make that language even better. I guess I would ask the good representative from Gillette to explain a little better why he thinks that guts the bill.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The failure to comply with or refusal to participate in the case plan developed by the department and the other language about refusal to comply with the case plan are important components of the bill because if you're not there, if you're not showing up, if you're not participating in the plan with your child, you really shouldn't have any opportunity to object. The Department of Family Services has taken your child into custody. Now, I think that there's some language that we can put in there to fix it, that it's a material deviation for the participation in the case plan or that you participate, you know, here's a good word that we debated a couple weeks ago, in good faith. In the process, I think that there's some language there that we can use to fix that so that if the Department of Family Services developed a case plan that you objected to, that you certainly could object to that. But I'm concerned that if nobody does anything and their child is in state custody for 15 to 22 months, that they really shouldn't have the ability to go, well, now, hey, wait a minute, you can't terminate my parental rights. I'm still a parent. because of the biological reasons and not the parental reasons.
Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In these cases, we have three different bodies that are telling parents what they need to do, what they have to do, what they need to comply with. We've got the district court saying, we want you to follow this order, and if you don't, you could be held in contempt. We have the NDT process that we talked about the other day that says, all of us as professionals are coming in here, and we want you to do this and this and this and this and this. We have our Department of Family Services who comes in and says, okay, now we've got this terrific case plan, and we want you to follow it. And if you don't agree with it, tough Twinkies, basically. We want you to do it anyway. Now, we have recently dealt with a situation where a man was working 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. He was also ordered to do three different meetings of large group type therapy, two different meetings of individual counseling. He was supposed to see his children X number of times a week through supervised visitation. He was supposed to do random UAs and still keep his job, even if he had to go in at 1 o'clock in the afternoon when his employer was. So this is part of the case plan. This was not part of a reasonable case plan. This was not part of something that he could actually function under and keep his family going. And it didn't matter that he had tried to say, wait, I cannot do all the things you're asking me to do and keep my job and keep my family going and do the things that I need to do for all of these other things. So when we say, when we put this in the definition, we are saying that it is neglect, period. If you fail to comply with or refuse to participate in a case plan developed by the department, that is not the only thing these folks have to comply with. And they don't really have a lot of input. We can already consider whether or not someone is complying with their case plan as part of whether or not someone is being neglectful to their children. That is already out there. We can already do that. The court can already order and say, you need to do X, Y, and Z. But we should not put this into our definition of neglect, because that then removes any real discretion that we have, and I would hope that we would vote for this amendment. I think that it does not gut this bill, but I think that it says we need to keep some reasonable things moving forward here, and I would ask for your support. Thank you.
Representative Peasley.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm suffering from an acute case of comprehension deprivation. I don't understand this bill. And I'm hoping that everyone here, when you vote on it, make sure you know what you're doing. The description of the bill by the representative from House District 31 led me to believe that perhaps the children in need of supervision over the last 20 years were the representatives in this fine house that were passing all these laws, that were patchworking something together to make juvenile services work. It seems like once we got involved and overactive, it all went downhill. You'll notice most of this bill that we're, this law that we're overhauling is less than 20 years old. It's been chopped up, spit out. We're putting lipstick on the wrong end of the pig. I think I'm going to, and I understand what the good representative from Teton County is trying to do, and I concur with him in his amendment. On the other hand, I'm not happy about the underlying problem. Thank you.
Madam Majority Whip.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm going to encourage the body to support this amendment. In committee, I too had problems with that language on page 3, lines 10 and 11. And I think this amendment is a good amendment. And I'm just going to urge the body to support this amendment. I think that taking those out makes this a better bill. And I just get really nervous when we start defining neglect as failure to comply with a case plan that's developed by DFS. I mean, we just have to think about what the long-term implications have for that. So on and in favor of the amendment.
Question being called.
All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 is passed. We have another Committee of the Whole Amendment. Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to House Bill, to Senate File 103 and ask for your favorable consideration. We just talked a little bit about one of the issues with this particular Senate file, and I have a few more. Now, some of the things that this bill does are really pretty good things. We're creating some dovetailing of jurisdiction that is going to expedite some of these processes in a way that I don't have a lot of concerns for lack of proper process, lack of proper procedure. We're doing some good things with some of those pieces within this bill. There are some other places that I obviously have some concerns if you've looked at this amendment at all. The meat of this amendment basically starts over on page 4, and it starts at line 15. If we look at some of the language above, where I just referenced, you can see where we're trying to create, again, some of that dovetailing between jurisdictions that actually is going to help improve some of the processes that we're looking at. And it's my understanding, as having read some of the things that came down prior to this Senate file coming forward, that this is really where we wanted to make some of these fixes. Then we kind of went a little farther. And in subsection C here, we talk about a party to the proceeding may file a petition for the adoption or appointment of a guardianship in the underlying juvenile action in lieu of filing a petition with the district court. I ask that be deleted. And part of the reason I ask that be deleted in my amendment is that juvenile court is a confidential proceeding. And I think that there is room for mischief with this, and I think that we need to be very careful about making sure that when we're going through these procedures and we're going through these processes, that we're doing it in the proper ways, that we're doing it in an open way. We shouldn't have anything secret running around out there. And I'm not saying that people would get out there and try to do nefarious things, but I think that some of the processes within juvenile court may inhibit some of the information that we want to make sure is available and out there and noticed up to some of these parents when we're moving forward. On page 5, I go in and I ask that we change the words custody of to parental rights to. And part of the reason that I ask for that, in fact, the main reason that I ask for that, is when you follow that through from line 4, it says, with respect to a child who is alleged to have been abused or neglected, a noncustodial parent or putative father who has not had custody of the child removed by a court and who is not alleged to have abused or neglected the child shall be served with notice. So this is the notice provision. Who are we going to tell that there's something going on about their child? And when I read that very part where it talks about custody of, I get concerned because I'm not sure I know exactly what that means. I think we need a very definite trigger, and it needs to be a high trigger for when we decide we're not going to give notice to somebody who is a parent to a child. And I think that trigger, that definite line, is when somebody's rights have been terminated, because that's the point at which they really don't have an expectation to know what's going on with their child. If you simply don't have custody of your child because maybe mom does, maybe dad does, maybe there's a guardianship, and yet, you know, so we want to be careful who we are excluding from this notice provision, and I think that we need to have in here that only when someone's rights have been terminated are they then excluded from those notice provisions. We talk about what needs to be in that notice on the remainder of page 5. I think it is absolutely imperative that we have good notice to the people that we are trying to get this information to. And so I applaud this effort. And this is part of what I also think is a good part of this bill. On page 6, when we look at lines 1 through 8, those are basically some good provisions as well. We want these putative fathers and these noncustodial parents to come in and get with the court, talk to them, let them know what's going on, become a part of this process. But what we don't want to do is in statute create situations that are the purview of the court that then the statute has then come in and taken over. When we talk about line 10, submit to the jurisdiction of the court, basically, if you have responded and appeared as required by the statutes listed and admitted or denied, you're already submitting to the jurisdiction of the court. You're coming in and saying, yeah, I want to be a part of this process. When we come in on number on Romanet 4 and say cooperate with the Department of Family Services, this should be part of a court order. This should not be part of a statute because it can be too big of a hammer, and we don't want to create those kind of hammers. We want the courts to be able to take a look at what the circumstances are and make those decisions on a case-by-case basis. We don't want that in statute. When we look at number 5, I think providing information as required by the court, absolutely. I have no problem with that. But I do have problems with saying that the multidisciplinary team or the Department of Family Services can also say, we're going to require X, Y, and Z of you. I think that we're looking at Fifth Amendment issues. I think that we're looking at all kinds of issues that need to, again, be the purview of the court and addressed by the court, not something in statute. When we say pay all child support as may be ordered by the courts, absolutely. I think that that's fine. But when you have a putative father out there and they just figured out they were dad and it might have been 2, 3, 4 years ago, you never know how much child support might be out there. And say they have to pay it all, that may be something where we need to say, no, the court needs to come in and help them set up a payment plan to make sure the state receives their money back so we're not going in and using that as a kick out for somebody who actually could be a very positive placement for a child. So what I do with that is I go in and I delete a number of the sections in there, the Romanets in there, and basically put in there that the judge may order that the person abide by any court order. And that means any court order currently or any court order of the past. So it could encompass child support. It could encompass any number of things so that that judge can take a look at it and we're not in statute creating something that people cannot work with in their lives. If you start at line 22 on page 6 and just kind of read through, this kind of turns into a de facto termination. And sometimes we can come up with 1,000 what ifs, but sometimes there is good cause for why someone did not get a response into a court or into a proceeding. And I think that we need to have a provision in here that says unless good cause can be shown for the failure to respond. And that's all I'm adding to that section is that, you know, if somebody was in the hospital with a serious back injury and simply wasn't home when the notice was mailed, who knows? We can come up with 1,000 reasons why this might be an issue. But we need to protect those people's rights where we can. And this is an easy fix to that potential problem. I then come in on line 4, page 7, and basically delete the service of process piece. And the reason I do that is because we already have service of process within Title 14 as well as within our Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure. What we've done within Title 14 and the service of process provisions, at least the way that I read them, is we have provided a pretty strict set of standards that we're going to make sure folks know what's going on. Rule 4 also does that. And it requires that you do a diligent search for people and that you not just willy-nilly exclude somebody. You have to go through processes. If we leave F in there, that waters down that process. We could have a non-resident maybe living in South Dakota who happens to be a parent. And we need to make sure that we are covering that person as well. And I use that particular state because that's my corner of our state. It could be any corner of this state where we're looking at issues where somebody just lives across the border. Maybe you don't know the exact address, and all of a sudden you can publish that in some itty-bitty once-a-week paper that nobody's ever going to read, and that is not fair service. So I hope that you can give this favorable consideration, and I would stand for questions.
Representative Meyer.
Madam Chairman, I appreciate the amendment that the good representative has brought, but I do have some questions on it. I've been a participant in MDT teams. I've worked with foster parents, and I know some of the issues that arise. And I think one of the things that we have to remember is, why do we have this bill? Yes, we need to protect the parents, but our main interest is protecting the child. And we have to be sure that by passing an amendment that has so many parts in it, what are we deleting and what are we doing? I just caution this body to think before we pass this amendment to be sure that we're not totally taking out that protection for the child. Yes, there are instances where the parents cannot be reached. There are instances that they need to participate, but they're not. And there are times that the parents have to take responsibility. I would urge this body to defeat this amendment. Let's pass the bill, and let's look at what we can do for those children. Because many times we are tying the hands of the foster parents to be guardians and to protect that child when the child is in their custody. I am confused as to what this amendment does. So I urge the body, until we have a better understanding of what we are doing and keeping in mind we still need to protect that child. Are there issues with some agencies and some of the plans? Perhaps there are. But there might be other ways that we can rectify it rather than through this amendment. So I urge you to defeat this amendment, pass the bill. Let's see if we can work out some of these issues if we need to in second reading amendments or even third reading amendments. But I just urge you to please defeat this amendment, and let's remember that the child and the children are whom we are here to protect. Thank you.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This seems like it's the Campbell County representative show between you and I and the good other representative from Campbell County. I apologize for that. On and against the amendment. Here's why. The language on page 4 allows the court to combine files. So if you've got a divorce going on that deals with custody, or you have an adoption going on that deals with custody, or a guardianship going on that deals with custody, you can just combine all the files. It's a judicial economy thing. So that's why that's important. The amendment to the top of page 5 says, where it's a proposal that you change it from having parental rights removed to having custody removed, is really a dangerous amendment, because what that says is that you only, if your parental rights have been terminated or removed, you don't have any rights to the child, so you don't have any rights to the notice. What we're talking about in this section is giving notice to all of the people who are entitled to notice. That means the non-custodial parent and the custodial parent. And so that is why it has to be the custody of the parents. The language on page 5, line 2 is fine about alleged in the petition. All of the stuff in page 6, what we're talking about is a notice. It's a notice that says, if you don't show up, these are the things that can happen. All of the deletions delete out the things that you have to notify somebody of. Most importantly is that if you use this deletion, you give a notice that says you have to respond as required and admit that he's the parent of the child, but we don't even tell them that they're going to lose custody of their child, which seems to me to be a bad idea in the amendment. The language about service of process on page 7, where we delete paragraph F, is also problematic, deleting things and then going to the rules of civil procedure. And the reason is you have to understand what 414 says on service of process. And what 414 says is that if you're in state, service has to be done personally, and tells how. if they can't be found within the state, and the court can order personal service outside the state by certified mail, and then it tells all of the things that have to happen there. And then if you can't do either one of those things, then it authorizes service by publication as provided by the Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure. And they're not willy-nilly rules. What happens is you have to have service by publication, but before service can be made, an affidavit of the party or the party's agent or attorney must be filed stating that service cannot be made, and all of the steps that you took to find the person, and you have to detail that with the court before you even get to do service by publication. So what this statute is doing and what this amendment is doing is making sure that before custody is taken away from a person, that we give all of the notice possible. If you look at Rule 4, there's all kinds of other alternative methods of service that are a lot broader than are what are authorized in 413. And so I think that this part of that amendment has a whole series of unintended consequences. So I would urge you to defeat the amendment and pass the bill.
Representative Peasley.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And again, I've got some questions of the good bringer of the bill and some comments, again, that have arisen since I last spoke to you from that side of the room. I hope all of you recognize how complex this is. And the good representative from Campbell County made that very clear. And I hate to tell you, I saw a lot of glazing over when we started talking about that. I went back and realized that this bill, the Child Protection Act, the one that seems to be the core of this, is only 11 years old. Seemed like the more we work at it here, the more we screw it up. And I, what bothers me about this, and I appreciate the efforts by the representative from District 53, because at least I see where you're splitting things off and separating the processes, and I see this bill as a frustrated effort by the judges to just make it all happen in one little kettle, and we'll handle all matters regarding children. And especially, and I'm going to ask these sort of as questions if I may, it's my understanding that the deletion of the, and again I'm kind of thinking this through as I go, on page 4, where a party to the proceeding may file a petition for adoption or appointment of a guardian, I assume that meant guardian, not guardianship, in an underlying juvenile action in lieu of filing a petition in district court, it's my understanding, and perhaps you can correct me, that a filing of a petition for adoption can be brought in the same court if the child, if the court has jurisdiction. All it is a matter of opening a different file and going through another process, which would be, it would seem important if we're going to deal with the life of a child and its future in an adoption proceeding, and instead of just having this bubble out of a child protection action, it would be better to have it separated. I'd like the good bringer of that amendment to explain that. And if that's the reason, it makes good sense to me. It also makes good sense to me, and I, again, when you amended 413 at page 5 and required this notification to a non-custodial parent or putative father who has not had parental rights to the child removed, is it your intention there to protect perhaps a good father who does not have custody and is otherwise being a good guy from being hammered just because he doesn't have custody? It seems that you're protecting you're protecting all fathers who have not had parental rights terminated, and that made good sense for me, to me, especially when you cover it with the as long as there's no allegations of abuse. Finally, again, I don't care a lot for the underlying bill, but I'd like to get it all cleaned up so I could vote against it. And the bringer of the amendment, it on page 6 again, where you have talked about removing the child support provisions. It's my understanding you've left that well protected, by saying that the person will provide information and abide by any order required of the court. Therefore, the court can cover not only child support, but a litany of other issues. And then finally, I did appreciate your concern about the need for good cause for failure to respond. Actually, I think this amendment does move the lipstick a little further up on the pig, and I think it does make this bill a little more palatable to me. It's a troublesome bill, and it covers a very important area of our world, an area in which we have involved ourselves exponentially more each year, and each year we make it worse. And I do agree with the previous representative that spoke that the amendment is complicated. But I want you to know the bill is complicated, and what we're talking about is complicated. And I don't understand it. I'm concerned about the implications, and so I'm on and for the amendment and against the bill.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I'm not an attorney. I don't really understand all this stuff, but I have a couple questions because I've had to deal with it with my constituents. And my constituents' concerns are there's all of these agencies out there, and they don't have the ability sometimes to ferret these things out. Things are happening sometimes without their knowledge, all of their knowledge. Things happen that they don't feel is right, that it's not in the best interest of their child. And all of these things happen without the court being involved in it or the county attorney. All these things are happening before there's some type of process where you get into the legalities of this. Now, if this bill is trying to move this stuff, and these all these amendments are trying to move this so there's more review quicker, then I support this. If not, we've already meddled in this stuff so much that I think everybody's confused, including the people that are trying to deal with it.
Representative Mercer. Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. It's kind of tough being caught between two members of my own county delegation, but I'd have to say that, in my opinion, these amendments that are being proposed by my good colleague, who also serves my town, I think these amendments are good because they're moving our system towards the courts being involved in these major decisions. I think that that's the place for them. One of the things that she brought up was the confidentiality aspects. Having witnessed pretty closely a recent case in my community, the confidentiality that was maintained in the MDT process was such that not even a member of the legislature could go there and observe it. So I think the public is not going to be well served if we don't allow this most important right. And I mean, we say that we're for the children. Yes, we're for the children. But part of the well-being of a child is his relationship to his parents. And if we're going to terminate these rights of parents to their children, we may not be serving children very well either. So I'm for the amendment, and I'm not sure about the bill. I'll wait and see how all the amendments turn out, but for the amendment. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to start a little bit with my friend from House District 31's comments. He commented that on page 4, we are allowing the court to combine files. And yes, that is some of the stuff that we're doing on page 4. And when you look at Romanets 1 and 2, we're asking for the courts to talk. What a concept, a little communication, that's a great idea. We need to do that. But when we look at C, the piece that I want to delete, what we're saying is that you can file that action in the juvenile court. The juvenile court is confidential. We're saying you can do that in lieu of filing in the district court. The district court is not confidential. I'm simply saying that by adding this provision to these statutes, we are injecting places where confusion can exist, and we are injecting places where that separation is going to get blurred, and we don't want to do that in these cases. When we talk about the parental rights piece on page 5, we're talking about notice to all who were entitled to have notice. That was the language that was used. That's absolutely what I want to see. I want to see everybody who is entitled to notice getting that notice. And that is exactly why I brought this language, rather than what I feel is a little bit fuzzy with when we only use the words custody. We need to have termination of parental rights as that trigger, that key to when we make that decision. On page 6, there was some discussion about how this is a notice provision. Let's take a look at it. It says, a noncustodial parent or putative father served with notice of the child protective proceeding shall. Okay, so they received the notice from the prior page saying all this stuff could happen on page 5. But when you receive that notice, this is what your duties are within this case. This is not just a notice provision of what could happen. This is a notice provision of you shall do these things. You shall participate in the way that this now says you should participate. And that's why we have to pull those things back out of that statute that have been put onto this amendment, because those things don't belong in that piece. They belong in the view of the purview of the court. When we look at F on page 7, there was some discussion about how the rules of civil procedure allow for a broader service of process than what is allowed for under 14.3.414. That's because that's the default position. That should be the default position. And that's where we need it to stay. We need to have 414 stay like it is. We shouldn't be messing with that the way we are here, and that's why I ask that that piece be deleted, because we need those stronger notice provisions, because we're talking about the fundamental right of a parent and a child to associate with each other. This is not just the fundamental rights of a child or the fundamental rights of a parent. This is the fundamental rights of a family to associate, and that's what we're talking about. As we move into some of the discussion, let's see, we had some questions by one of our representatives out of House District 3. I appreciate his clarification that we need to keep these things separate to a degree. This does combine things. That's what this bill is about, is combining some of these jurisdictions. But we need to keep the fringes from getting too muddy. And that's what I'm trying to do with these amendments. I absolutely believe in trying to protect those good fathers who don't have custody. That is absolutely what I want to do. Those good fathers, those good mothers, whoever that non-custodial parent might be. I don't want to limit the court's jurisdiction, and I don't want to limit the court's ability to order what's going to be good in a case, and that's why we have the provisions that were added on page 6 in my amendment. We also heard from our representative out of House District 54. And I also hear a lot of these concerns about how we're not really getting good assessments. We're not really getting the good information that we need to have. We're not getting the reviews that we need to have. Now, some of that stuff, and you hear this every year, it's in process. And we are working on it through some of the different groups that are trying to help make these pieces of our child protective services work better. We are absolutely working on those things, but they aren't ready for all the pieces of this bill, and that's why we need to step back and say, slow down, we can't do this yet, because we're going to be stomping on folks' rights. And it's not just the parents' rights, it's also the children's rights, because they have a right to associate with their parents. The last concern that I'm going to address is from my prior desk mate. And I already did that a little bit. But this is absolutely about protecting children. This is absolutely about trying to make sure that these processes are working the right way. And in order to do that, we have to make sure that we're not demonizing parents. And so many times, that's exactly what you see, is you see the demonization of parents through these processes. And that's the easy default position. We need to make sure as a body that we are protecting the rights of those parents, protecting the rights of those children, that we are paying attention to some of the statistics that say a child who is in out-of-home placement is more likely to be abused than a child in their own crummy home. We've got to take care of the fact that we need to work with those families together, not yank them apart, as much as we possibly can. And that is the position I come from as my basic position on this bill, and I hope that you can share that position with me. Thank you.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just real quick, this bill wasn't supposed to be this complicated. Let me just explain this real fast. Here's what happens. So you have a kid in juvenile court. The kid's in juvenile court. You're going along. You're doing stuff. And all of a sudden, people figure out, well, probably this kid shouldn't be with mom or dad. We need to find a permanent placement for this kid. What normally happens is then you have to go refile a totally new case with a whole new folder in the district court clerk's office, and someone has to pay for that filing fee, and then you have two cases sitting next to each other. They have the same exact facts, and it's the same judge, because our district court judge and our juvenile court judge are the same person. All the judges were asking for was the ability to combine the cases. They just wanted to put them together to speed up the whole process, because it seems sort of silly to be proceeding with juvenile court over here and then proceeding with an adoption or a guardianship proceeding over here on the same kid with the same fact scenario. They just wanted to put the two together. That's all this bill was trying to do. As for this amendment, I actually consider the amendment to be a bunch of just cleanup stuff. I don't find anything real earth-shattering in the amendment other than one little section. So just because it's after four anyway, I'll divide the amendment. Division one would just be lines 11 and 12. Everything else is division two.
Representative Gingrey, Division 1, lines 11 and 12 on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2. Everything else is Division number 2.
Correct.
Please proceed.
And what this section does, just on Division 1, 11 and 12, lines 11 and 12 on the amendment, is on page 4. And all that section was doing, it said, a party to the proceeding may file a petition for adoption or appointment of guardianship in the underlying juvenile action in lieu of filing a petition with the district court. That needs to stay in. That was the whole impetus of the whole bill. That's why the district court judges brought it to us. So I would urge you to vote no on Division 1, and the rest of Division 2 is fine. It's just we need that to stay in there, because that was the whole reason for bringing the bill. So on Division 1, I would ask you to vote no.
Representative Mercer?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Again, I think that this opens us up to some mischief that we really don't want to see. I think it fuzzies some lines that we don't want fuzzied. If you need to go in and you need to file for an adoption, you need to do it from the district court and then move that over, not from the juvenile court and back. That would be my position on that. I agree with trying to dovetail some of these jurisdictions, but I do not agree with this particular provision.
Representative Peasley.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And in hopes of bringing this all together in a group hug here and making this get resolved, let me ask the good representative from Teton County, if this is what the judges are in a Twitter about, they have jurisdiction over both these courts, over the same clerk, and they're in the same office, and the file cabinets are a couple feet apart. I understand why they don't want to waste two file folders, but I would think the clerks are always looking for an additional filing fee. If all we're saving here is a filing fee and the opening of a file, and if the judges don't think that the blending of these two concepts of juvenile action and an adoption action is prejudicial, I don't have a problem, but I don't know why the judges just couldn't do it anyway. In other words, I think if that's the only problem we got, I can get past it.
Chairman Gingrey?
Madam Chair, it's a little more than just combining files. It's this idea that the parent is already in the juvenile court system, maybe involuntarily, but they're in it. To go do an adoption or a guardianship, you're going to have to, A, go find an attorney. So now this person who didn't, you know, they're going to have to go spend some money. They're also going to have to go pay for the filing fee. And a lot of times that's the roadblock where the judge is telling them in juvenile court, you really ought to file for guardianship or you really ought to file to adopt the kid permanently. And the people are saying, well, you know, that's going to cost a lot of money. What the judges were just saying was, boy, it'd be nice, since there's already an underlying cause of action, that they could just file within that underlying cause of action. That was the impetus of the concept, and maybe the majority floor leader can illuminate more, since he's the one who met with the judges.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The good representative from House District 23's right on this division, and I like the amendment as a whole, but I would reject the division as he iterated. It's basically just makes it more clear that in the cases I've had, some kids are brought in, they're neglected by mom, and the three kids have three different fathers, and the one father shows up and says, you know, I've got my life together, I've remarried, I'm doing all this great stuff, and DFS says, oh, that's great. And it just makes clear that their attorney can come right into juvenile court, file the petition, and we're done. There's no guessing and having two different files or anything like that. So the division is a good division. I would urge you to reject that portion and then adopt the amendment.
We are on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, Division Number 1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Division number 1 to Committee of the Whole number 2 to Senate File 103 fails. We're now on Division number 2. Mr. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just urge the body to vote aye on this. There may be some small concerns in there, but this can be the House position. We can work it out in conference committee. But I find most of these just to be cleanups that the good representative from Gillette caught, and I would urge you to vote aye on division number 2.
We are voting on division number 2 to Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2, Senate File 103. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Division number 2 passes. We are back on the bill. Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 103 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 103 passes Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
Yay!
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Will the reading clerk please read the committee of the whole report?
Mr. Speaker, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. Senate File 5, recommended do pass. Senate File 132, recommended do pass. Senate File 11, I'm sorry, Senate File 111, recommended do pass. Senate File 137, recommended do pass. Senate File 125, recommended do pass. Senate File 32, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Representative Buchanan moved that the committee of the whole move that the committee of the whole rise and sit again. Senate File 75, recommended do pass. Senate File 95, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 62, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 46, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 53, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 17, recommended do pass. Senate File 103, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Wallace, Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the committee of the whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Wallace. Appreciate it. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 236. Mr. Speaker, House Bill 11, Dogs Chasing Wildlife. The House bill listed above passed on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Ayes 26, noes 3, excused 1. The Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Message 237, Mr. Speaker, House Bill 19, Criminal Procedure Mental Evaluations. The House bill listed above passed on a third reading in an amended form is by the vote that follows. Ayes 28, noes 1, excused 1. The Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Message 238, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 23, Game and Fish Penalties, ayes 28, noes 1, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 239, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 29, Tribal Participation in Community Facilities Program, ayes 17, noes 12, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 240, Mr. Speaker, House Bill 34, Liquor Licensees, Industry Representatives. The House bill listed above passed the Senate in third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 28, noes 1, excused 1. The Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 241. Mr. Speaker, the bills as below passed Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 49, Marriage Licenses. Ayes 26, noes 3, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 242. The bill, Mr. Speaker, the bills as below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 59, Liquor Licenses, Golf Clubs. Ayes 27, noes 1, excused 1, conflict 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 243, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 88, Game and Fish Pioneer Licenses. Ayes 26, noes 3, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 244, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 93, Complementary Hunting Licenses. Ayes 27, noes 2, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 245, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 110, Wyoming Business Ready Community Program. Ayes 20, noes 9, excused 1. Signed, Diane Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 246, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below failed to pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 112, Workforce Housing Program. Ayes 14, noes 15, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Mr. Speaker, message 247. The House Bill number 20, Criminal Procedure, Administration of Antipsychotic Drugs. The House bill listed above passed in third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Ayes 24, noes 5, excused 1. The Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 248. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 57, Ownership of Poor Space, Dominance of Mineral Estate. I-17, noes 12, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 249. Mr. Speaker, the Senate did concur on House amendments to bills listed below by the vote indicated. Senate File 58, Vehicle, Title, and Registration. Ayes 28, noes 0, excused 2. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 84 engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne, signed representing Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred Senate File 140, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Throne, excused, Quarburg, signed representing Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom is referred Senate File 56, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phillips, Stewart, signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom is referred Senate File 68, engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phillips, Stewart, signed representing Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 37 engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Mooney, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, Wanitzer, Dan, excused, Blake, signed representing Semlek, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File number 2 engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Lubno, Miller, Stubson, Wanitzer, Dan, signed Representative Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 104 engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Lubno, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan, signed representing Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 45, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Lubno, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan, signed Representative Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 54, engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Escobel, Goggles, Harvey, Landon, Millen, Shepperson. No, Davison, Hallinan. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
Committee announcements, Chairman Illaway.
Can we re-refer?
Please.
Mr. Speaker, I ask to re-refer Senate File 42 from your committee number 7 to your committee number 2 appropriations.
Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Any other re-referrals? Chairman Semlett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I request that Senate File 37 be referred to committee number 2 as it has an appropriation. Thank you.
Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Any other re-referrals? Chairman Semlett, do you have a committee announcement?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet Thursday, February 19th at 8 a.m. to hear the following Senate files. Senate File 114, Engrossed Animal Control. Senate Joint 4, Engrossed Blacktail Prairie Dogs. And, Mr. Speaker, Senate File 34, Beginning Agriculture Producer Finance Authority. Thank you.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet tomorrow upon adjournment in room H10, where we will take up Senate File 47, Engrossed Hathaway Student Scholarship Program Administration, Senate File 52, Engrossed School Bus Seatbelts, and Senate File 35, Youth Access to Tobacco Cessation Programs.
Chairman Cohey.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet 10 minutes upon adjournment this evening, Tuesday, February 17th, in room H17 to discuss Senate File 60, Engrossed National Guard Youth Challenge Program, Senate File 76, Snowplows, Emergency Lights, and Senate File 57, Engrossed Rental Vehicles.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, will meet tomorrow afternoon upon adjournment in H17 to hear Senate File 106, Medication Disposal Program, and Senate File 49, Psychologist Licensure.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. for an educational meeting on drug courts presented by the Department of Health. And then on Thursday at 8 a.m., we will take up Senate File 107, Court Supervised Treatment Programs Act.
Vice Chairman Stevenson.
Mr. Speaker, your Chairman number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet tomorrow at 8 a.m. in H18 to discuss Senate File 115, Investment of State Funds Revisions, and Senate File 101, Trona Utility Shot Fire Certification.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet Wednesday morning, February the 18th at 8 a.m. in room H10 to finish Senate File 13, Engrossed Shed Antler Collection, and to hear Senate File 14, Engrossed State Historic Sites Appropriation.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Hot off the press, your Appropriations Committee number 2 will meet to review re-referred bills, Senate File 42, Local Government, and Senate File 37, something related to agriculture, antifreeze and petroleum products. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Conference Committee on House Bill 9 will meet in the Senate Corporations Room as soon as the Senate Ag Committee is done with the State Lands Leasing Bill to confer on House Bill 9.
Any other announcements? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that we adjourn until Wednesday, February 18, 2009 at 10 a.m.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. We are adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.